Welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. This show offers an intellectual discussion on technologically enabled disruption, because investing in innovation starts with understanding it. To learn more, visit arc-invest.com.
ARK Invest is a registered investment advisor focused on investing in disruptive innovation. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. It does not constitute, either explicitly or implicitly, any provision of services or products by ARK. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK or podcast guests and are not endorsements or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Clients of ARK Investment Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Hello, welcome to FYI, the four-year innovation podcast. My name is Brett Winton. I'm ARK Invest's chief futurist and the host of FYI. With me today, I have Nemo. Nemo is our multiomics analyst and a PhD and an expert. We're going to talk a little bit about multiomics, and then we have an exciting conversation for you. Who are we talking to today, Nemo?
Yes, we are talking today with Professor Nikolai Slavov. He's a professor of bioengineering at Northeastern University, and his research focus is single-cell proteomics, immunology, cancer drug resistance, translation, quantitative system biology, mass spec, and the RNA degradation.
Great. So we refer to the technology platform that you focus on as multiomics. We used to call it genomics, and now we call it multiomics. What is multiomics, and how does it relate to proteins, which we're going to be talking about with Professor Slavov?
Happy to. So to kind of understand this, we need to kind of go through a central dogma of molecular biology. So every cell has the DNA, which is the coding information, which is the nucleic acid. The DNA gets transcribed into the RNA, which is another type of the nucleic acid, which conveys the information from DNA to the cell, which proteins to make. And then the proteins are the third part of this equation. So DNA is the information scaffold. RNA transfers the information and enables making the proteins, who are actually the doers, or they execute the functions in the cell. So that's the kind of what we have there. And in addition, we also have epigenome, which sits on the top of the DNA, and it's saying which RNA will be made or not. So it's kind of controlling. And so putting all this together is what we call multiomic.
Sure. So it's like DNA should be kind of the same in every cell. It's this recipe that's inside your body that tells your body how to construct itself. But each cell will be producing different or reading different parts of that recipe depending on upon the cell's function. And that is the kind of like RNA piece that's in each cell. And then that goes and tells the protein making machinery, or basically is used to then make the proteins, which operate in the body. But then the proteins themselves can change over time, and they can get cut in half, and they can kind of get degraded at different levels. So to really have a full understanding of what's going on, you at the very least, it's not enough just to read the same thing that's shared across all of the cells. It's not enough to just read kind of the machinery that is translating that. You also probably need to read the underlying, and in fact, definitely need to read the underlying proteins, which are performing operations in the body, to really understand what's going right and what's going wrong.
Exactly. I think in an ideal case scenario, we would like to be able to read everything at once, the DNA, RNA, protein, and the epigenome, and then we can really understand really fully what's happening in the cell, because all these things can regulate itself. You know, proteins are also controlling which new RNAs is going to be transcribed as well. So given how complex and interconnected and how many feedback loops there is, you know, reading all of this is the ideal case. Until we'll reach that, you know, we are still not there. And so reading at least two or three at the same time of these kind of molecular species is extremely important for us to actually deconvolute or decode the cellular behavior.
And so when people talk about the proteome, they're talking about looking at the actual proteins maybe in like a large sample, or in the case of Professor Slavov, in at an individual cell, what are the proteins that are there, and in what abundance are they, and maybe even like what form do they take?
Exactly. So when we think about kind of proteome, you know, we can be looking at, we are looking at the kind of top down. So we are trying to see at scale what different kind of protein species are together. And so what we have been doing usually, it's kind of taking a bulk sample and doing that. What Professor Slavov recently has shown is that this can be done at the resolution of the single cell. Why is that is important? Because, you know, cell is the fundamental functional unit of life or biology. It's think about, it's a basically like a chip in a computer. So for us, we need to be at that resolution because disease happens at the cell resolution. Our drugs, you know, are made to work on that. So being able to actually look at the proteome with a single cell is really, really important. And his newest research was showing that that can be actually done.
And so in the conversation, we'll talk about a number of different techniques that people use to take pictures of the proteome, call it. Could you briefly list three of them? And then there's companies associated with them, like, you know, which company is commonly associated with which one, or name a company for each one?
Absolutely. So proteome, proteomics is a huge space. And so there are multiple different efforts trying to kind of decipher this complex issue. But some of them to mention is the companies such as Standard BioTools, which with SomaLogic, for example, which was acquired, is using aftermers to detect and quantify numbers of proteins at the same time. Then we have companies such as QuantumSci, which is basically trying to sequence the proteins, and it's more of the bottom-up approach, looking at single proteins individually. Then we have companies such as 908, which basically managed to miniaturize mass spec, which is one of the main methods to actually study the proteins. In addition to these ones, we have much bigger companies such as Thermo Fisher, Danaher, who are also very, very active in this space and have different methods to kind of read proteome.
Yeah. And to me, like every time we talk about multiomics and biology, it is so apparent that we are in every one of our technologies, we believe we're in kind of early innings and even first pitches of the story. Within biology, it seems like we haven't even started the ballgame in some ways, in terms of like the level of crudeness that we are able to measure things that are that kind of impact the way we live and kind of our ability to develop drugs is really apparent. And so there's a set of tools that are out there, and it's clear that those tools need to improve, and there are probably new tools that need to be developed to really understand what's going on at the protein level in the body. Do you agree?
Yes. I think we often forget how biology is a science. It's a pretty young science. You know, in 1950-something was a Nobel Prize for the actually saying that DNA goes to RNA and then to the protein, and the DNA is actually the information that decodes everything. And that's that's such a big fundamental seminal research in biology, equivalent to basically Newton's laws in physics. And that just happened, 78 years ago. So since then, biology, did move really, really fast. But given the complexity that we are dealing with, right, there is so much, much, much more to do. And then, again, to just kind of showcase this, like 1950-something was like DNA is the information that codes everything. But 2003, we have been able to sequence first human genome. So it is fast, just the complexity that you're dealing is wholesome, let's say like that.
Right. And the way I think about how this translates into business is we develop these new tools. First, the tools are used for people just understanding what's going on. It's like, I need to, understand what this protein is or what it does or how it impacts this particular disorder that people have, then it begins to be translated into, hey, we can then use that new insight to develop a drug. So it begins to go into the kind of biopharma R&D side. And potentially, if it's a meaningful enough mechanism, then we package it into some sort of diagnostic where, hey, this is something that we can measure, maybe in a cancer sample, to know exactly what drug to give to you, to know what's going on inside your body. And so these are the directions that these technologies go. And I think the reason to believe that these tools, not only are the tools improving, but the utility of the tools is going, should improve because of all of the stuff that's happening with AI, our ability to kind of use the data to correctly interpret what's going on in the body is improving really rapidly.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you think about biology, we usually think about diseases and, you know, studying that. But biology is fundamentally the biggest data science that exists. And so thinking like that, we then really understand that tools which help us actually read the data and make the sense of the data are the kind of key winners here. Because given the whole complexity that exists just of the system, and then we have to add biology is dynamic. So there's a huge complexity to start with, which changes and constantly adapts over time to different responses. So when you think about all of that, it's really about reading the data. It's where is the kind of biggest bottleneck. And better we get into that, the applications and the traceability becomes much more successful.
Yeah. And so you'll get a kind of a slice of this into proteomics with our conversation with Professor Slavov. We hope you enjoy it and thank you for joining FYI.
So maybe first where we could start is just trying to explain to our audience why the proteins are important in the human body in general.
Good morning to everyone. So I'm going to give you two versions of this explanation. One version is going to be giving you an intuitive sense of what proteins are. Sometimes we think of proteins as being strings of amino acids, or we think of being these elaborate structures that we have measured with X-ray crystallography or AlphaFold, this increasingly being able to predict. But proteins are unlike either of those. They're actually these really, really dynamic molecules that are constantly changing shape millions of times per second, interacting with other molecules. They're very, very social creatures. And there are billions upon billions of molecules in your body that are forming tiny little motors that are spinning very, very fast and making energy. And there are other proteins that are making scaffolds around tiny lipid vesicles to transport them as cargo. And this whole thing looks absolutely stunningly beautiful. So the normal picture that we have of proteins as being static structures or being linear strings of amino acids is far more boring than the reality of what proteins are. These very, very dynamic molecules. And as perhaps everybody knows, and it's being repeated multiple times, proteins perform most functions in the human body, from digesting the food to making energy to making our muscles flex to defending us from invaders, from infections and so on, creating urine, creating everything that we need to be alive and happy. Yes. And not surprisingly, given all of these functions, proteins are the primary target of drugs. Over 90% of FDA-approved drugs target proteins. And this is true for common drugs over the counter that many of us take, such as aspirin or Advil. These drugs inhibit enzymes known as cyclooxygenases, and they relieve our inflammation, our pain. And other drugs that we take under much more serious conditions, such as melanoma to prevent metastasis, they inhibit BRAF, another kind of enzyme, a kinase that attaches a phosphate group on molecules. And when that enzyme is very active, it makes cells divide too fast, it makes cancer cells metastasize. And if we're able to specifically inhibit enzymes performing these functions, we are able to achieve the desired effect. And this example of BRAF is actually illustrative of a very large class of drugs currently under development at various stages that aim to target kinases. Another very large class of drugs targets proteins inserted in the membrane known as 7 transmembrane proteins, the protein coupled receptors, such information and tell the cells what to do. And being able to influence that informational flow is very effective means in some cases to treat diseases.
So it makes sense to me, like you say, proteins do everything in the body. wow, we should really have a better understanding of what's what proteins are in the body and in which cells and operating at which times. So one, talk about some of the tools we use to do that. But then two, it seems like, is it enough to just measure kind of, oh, these proteins are here, since they are such dynamic kind of molecules that really transform over time?
These are wonderful questions, and I'm going to preface my responses by saying that we know surprisingly little about the proteome. It remains a vast, uncharted territory because it is huge. We normally think of the genome as being large or the transcriptome. There are orders upon orders of magnitude smaller than the proteome. And not just in terms of mass and numbers of amino acids, the proteome is very complex in terms of various modifications and chemical complexity. And this is before we even consider this very important aspect that I mentioned, that proteins are social creatures, that they interact with each other. It's not only enough to know what proteins we have, we really want to know who is interacting with whom. That's crucial. We want to know what their conformations are and what they're doing. And it's enormously wondrous and complex. And our tools to investigate all of this are relatively primitive. And the investment in those tools has been relatively modest. Over the last 20 or so years, NIH has invested billions of dollars in developing methods for nucleic acid analysis. It has a special institute focused on investing in nucleic acid analysis. And there's no equivalent to invest in analyzing proteins. The situation is such that we don't even know, we've never been able to apply a discovery method to determine the amino acid sequences of proteins. And the sequences that we have in our databases, in our textbooks, are sequences that are predicted from a model from 1960s, a model derived based on in vitro measurements from bacterial extracts. And this uncharted territory is the dream of a scientist. I think that there is a lot that we can discover that then can in turn empower clinical applications and new technologies. But that being said, a little bit for the state of our current knowledge, let me go back to the first part of your question of what are the methods that we use to analyze proteins. And to make it easier for people to understand, I will break them into three large categories. The first category is one of affinity reagents. When we have a molecule, whether that's an antibody or a DNA aptamer, that recognizes an epitope. Epitope is just a fancy word to say a spot on a protein. And we put these molecules inside of our sample, and we hope that they only bind those spots on specific proteins and nothing else. And then we have some readout to say how many of those were bound. And the major challenge of these methods that have existed for decades is that it is very difficult to achieve high specificity. And generally, we struggle with specificities. A very large number of scientific studies in the literature are retracted because of poor specificities of antibodies. There have been famous examples of major failures because of that poor specificity. It's a difficult problem to resolve. That's one of the weaknesses of those methods. They don't determine the sequence of a protein. They don't see the full-length protein. They're just seeing a spot on that protein and potentially binding non-specifically a lot of other spots in other proteins that are much more abundant.
So just to clarify, so when you say it fails, it's basically they thought it was protein X, but instead it was protein Y that it was binding to that exactly. Then causes the failure.
Exactly. Yeah. And perhaps to give some intuition why this is so hard is that protein X can be present at a millionfold lower abundance than protein Y. So even if the aptamer has higher abundance for protein X, when we have a millionfold more copies of protein Y, statistically, it becomes likely that even a low affinity binding to protein Y can have more affinity molecules, aptamers, antibodies bound to protein Y rather than protein X. And this is a very, very difficult problem to resolve, especially in the intracellular environment of a cell, which is very crowded. You should imagine it as being the most crowded train ever conceivable. Imagine this is not comfortable sitting first class. This is a super, super crowded environment with molecules flying all around, and therefore high probability of the antibody sticking to the wrong protein or the aptamer or whatever other affinity molecule we are using. So this is one category. Another major category of methods is mass spectrometry. And mass spectrometry basically measures the masses of proteins, of peptides with very, very high precision and accuracy. We can measure masses that are with six significant figures. We can measure an electron, less than the mass of an electron. Turns out that weighing a protein very precisely is not enough to determine its sequence. Then what happens is we break that protein into pieces and we measure the masses of all of the pieces. And then we put it together. It's very much like putting together a puzzle. And if we have measured all of the pieces and putting together the puzzle is relatively easy. If we have measured only half of the pieces or less, then putting together the puzzle becomes a real computational challenge. But mass spectrometry methods have been widely deployed as the most specific and powerful methods for protein analysis and modifications of proteins for decades. The major weaknesses of mass spectrometry is that it requires sophisticated instruments. It's a beautiful marvels of engineering and technology. And that means expertise, and that means money. And mass spectrometry can de novo sequence proteins, meaning that even if we didn't know what protein we have, such as an antibody never seen before, we can de novo determine the sequence. But this is quite challenging and relatively low throughput. So most of the time, the way we use mass spectrometry is we have a database of possible protein sequences. We acquire that fingerprint of protein masses and masses of their fragments. We match it together and statistically determine is this match with much higher confidence than you would expect by chance alone. And this allows us to essentially fingerprint or identify proteins and peptides. And the last thing to say about mass spectrometry, we can follow up more on this and talk later, is that while it has existed for a long time, because of its complexity and jargon, one of the secrets that not many people appreciate is how much the sensitivity and throughput of mass spectrometry proteomics has increased in recent years. Over the last decade, we have gained over four orders of magnitude, 10,000-fold higher sensitivity and over 100-fold higher throughput over the last 20 years. We have increased throughput by over 1,000-fold, not 1,000%, 1,000-fold. And there is a more detailed discussion of this question in a Nature Methods perspective that we published last year. And I'll provide a link to the notes of this podcast for listeners who are interested to see more details about this. And the third category of methods, which is the newest comers on the scene, are methods aiming to analyze single molecules. And those methods can be particularly powerful to do sequencing, though none of those methods at this point, to my knowledge, can sequence peptides at this point in proteins. But there are a variety of different approaches. Some of them determine sequences by degrading peptides, removing one amino acid at a time, and then labeling this with a fluorophore to see which amino acid was determined. Another class of single molecule methods is to run a peptide or a protein through a tiny, tiny pore, and because it's tiny, we call it nanopore, using methods similar to the third generation methods for nucleic acid sequencing, but sequencing peptides and proteins. And these methods are very new on the scene. There has been substantial amount of interest, investment, excitement in these methods. And they have the potential to provide more economic, accessible options to research groups who don't have access to more expensive established methods such as mass spectrometry. And because these methods are newer, there is also the potential for a lot more development in coming years. The major conceptual difficulty that I see with all of these methods is the size of the proteome. Single molecule analysis works quite well with transcriptomes because transcriptomes are relatively small. They're only about a few hundred thousand RNA molecules per human cell. That's 10 to the fifth. They're about 10 billion protein molecules per human cell. That's 10 to the 10th. So there is a huge gap in terms of number of molecules that need to be counted if we want to get a reliable comprehensive coverage of the transcriptome versus getting a reliable comprehensive coverage of the proteome. And this is a substantial challenge for any single molecule method. And in the Nature Methods perspective that I discussed, we have also focused on potential conceptual approaches to address this issue and what this means for the analysis. What is an important point to be made in this context is that for the single molecule proteomics approaches to be productively deployed, they don't need to analyze the complete proteome. There can be experiments and contexts where we analyze much simpler mixtures of proteins and we need to count fewer molecules. And those are the areas where these methods are likely to first find practical applications.
Can you actually talk about, almost the practical experimentation side of this? Like the way I understand how you're discussing transcriptome versus proteome, it's like if you have, I think you said it was, how many proteins? It was a 100,000. Yeah, okay, in the billions. The reason that number is important is because it means if you're going to get a full sampling, you have to find the one in a billionth part. Whereas kind of like the sampling you need to do, you know, and even full transcriptome, you're probably not getting the one in 100,000th part, but you're getting the very small proportion of things and detecting those, right?
Right.
What does that actually inform within the proteome context? Is it like, I'm looking for this specific protein that I think is causing a problem, or I'm trying to discover just what proteins are there so I can figure out what's solving a problem? Can you like talk in the kind of like the practical, like what would be a research piece somebody's trying to grab with this stuff?
Mm-hmm. So one particular research could be general question that comes up often is discovery type of analysis. We want to characterize how the proteome of the cells in one condition, for example, inflamed macrophages, differs from resting macrophages that are not inflamed, or cancer cells that are metastatic versus cancer cells that are not metastatic. And we may have a prior hypothesis exactly which protein is different and important. And in that case, we may use an affinity reagent and hope that that affinity reagent only binds the protein of our hypothesis of interest and nothing else. Or we may think that our hypothesis is limited. Maybe we want to apply a discovery approach. We just want to discover everything that is different. And if we want to discover everything that is different, let's say at the level of the transcriptome, it is sufficient to count thousands of transcripts. And this gives us a good chance that we're going to count both the highly abundant and the lowly abundant transcripts and be able to discover that lowly abundant transcription factor that is different between inflamed and non-inflamed cells. In the case of the proteome, if we wanted to do the comprehensive coverage and we count thousands of molecules, the number that we counted for the transcriptome, we are mostly going to detect histones, ribosomal proteins, actin, and a few other highly abundant proteins. If we wanted to be able to discover lowly abundant transcript factors that might be present at a million-fold lower copy number than histones, then we just need to count a larger number of protein molecules. And if we're doing this, counting one molecule at a time, this is quite well. If, on the other hand, we have the more targeted approach where we already have hypotheses of what is different and we are able to in some way enrich a subset of the proteomes that are not 10 billion proteins per cell, but we're reaching to a million or 100,000, then it becomes more feasible to apply a single molecule counting approach, where we might have the bandwidth, the counting power, to detect the lowly abundant transcription factor that is different, or the lowly abundant protein molecule whose conformational or phosphorylation state transmits the information that is driving metastasis.
It seems to me that, like, I'm also approaching this or hearing this and thinking about, okay, well, one, like, why isn't there investment funding going to this? Two, this sounds, as with all things in biology, like incredibly complex and just the very surface layer of many layers of complexity beneath it. But then three, like, what is happening now that makes this more interesting? You cover on the instrument side, there's kind of like advances in our ability to do this stuff, but also on, or I assume on the biological understanding side, with being able to do essentially kind of computational understanding of protein structures, or at least some like guesses at protein structures in a kind of more cost-efficient way than we were previously able to, it seems like the hypotheses could be better. And so you can use a more precise instrument to then kind of like detect the thing that you're looking for. Is that a thing that's improving? And does that characterize it well?
I think you're moving exactly in the right direction. So on one side, we have those rapid technological advances on multiple fronts. Older established methods are becoming orders of magnitude more powerful with new instrumentation, new ideas. Ideas actually for how we acquire the data with mass spectrometry have really driven a lot of progress. And this has been one of the major areas where my laboratory has made progress. So I'll just take a couple of minutes to give one example to explain this point, because I think it is important. It is not just having the best and the most powerful instrument, but about 7-8 years ago, most experts believe that mass spectrometry lacks the sensitivity to quantify proteins in single cells, and they were not even attempting to perform this analysis. And based on some simple estimates that we did, I believe at the time that we should be able to do that, and that we have the sensitivity to detect lots of ions from proteins from a single cell. But the challenge was that process of identifying the peptide sequence, because we need to detect enough pieces of the puzzle, as I discussed earlier today, to be able to determine which protein, which peptide we are analyzing. And we figured out an approach that we introduced, ScopeMS, that was able to identify the sequence based on peptides derived from larger number of cells, therefore having more copy numbers, more pieces of the puzzle, while being able to do the quantification on a per single cell basis. So that was a new way of data acquisition, a new experimental design that really enabled to do something that more advanced equipment couldn't do without the new data acquisition approach. And then once there was a demonstration that we're able to do this analysis, that mass spectrometry actually has a sensitivity, that in turn changed the thinking in the field and stimulated many more people to start developing instrumentation, to start developing methods to further advance this aspect. So there is also the element of what we believe is possible that then informs what we invest in, what we do. And sometimes technological advances can be limited by the beliefs that we had, by what we think is possible. So in addition to advances in instrumentation, there is also advances in ideas, experimental designs, which I think are very important enabling factor. And because of these advances, because of the new technologies, and because of the widespread application of proteomics throughout industry, there is significant interest and investment on the side of companies and industry into proteomics. The place where the investment is much more modest is within nonprofit research within academia, which mostly has to do with NIH portfolio, and perhaps that has very complex origins as to where NIH is investing. But one factor that might be contributing to that is that influential leaders of NIH over the last 20 years or so were people who built their careers as part of the sequencing of the Human Genome Project. They had a lot of experience with nucleic acid analysis, and they placed a lot of emphasis on continuing to advance nucleic acid analysis. And to the extent that there are fewer intellectual leaders, technology leaders being educated within academic environments, to the extent that there are fewer methods being developed, that also limits what is being deployed later on in industry and in the for-profit sphere. So all of these things are changing to a degree, but it remains the case that every year NIH spends billions of dollars in supporting nucleic acid analysis without having commensurate support for protein analysis. And to a degree, that is limiting progress. A counteracting force is that because of the substantial advances of the technology, increasing capabilities that are happening, and the broader appreciation that studying proteins is not an option. This is, if we want to understand biology, if we want to develop effective therapies, we also need to study proteins. That understanding is very firm, that is gaining increasing appreciation. So there is a development towards having more investment, having more technological advances. And we're just at the beginning of the huge mountain that we need to climb, because a lot of our conversation so far has centered around just detecting and quantifying protein composition. But I told you that proteins are incredibly social molecules. They interact together, they change conformations, they're moving dynamically, they move from one place in the cell, from the cytoplasm to another, to the nucleus. They regulate each other. And this is essentially what makes life possible. Without being able to measure those things and be able to link them to the various therapies that we develop, our therapies are going to be less predictable, they're going to have unintended consequences. We're going to have a high failure rate of what appears to be promising in early clinical stages, because that was predicted from nucleic acid sequences, that was predicted from the genetic code from 1960s. And we didn't really focus enough attention to do the direct measurements to see what it is that the proteins are doing. If we don't have that information, then fundamentally we have more uncertainty. If we have more uncertainty, we can expect to have a higher probability of advanced stage drug not behaving the way we would like it to behave.
Yeah, maybe the follow-up question there, when I think about kind of, you know, studying the proteins, right, I kind of see two different approaches, what I call kind of bottom-up, so crystallography, or those where I'm trying to kind of, you know, go from sequence to a structure, and then there's this top-down, which is like a composition interactions. Can you kind of contrast those two different kind of ways to study about proteins, and which is the more important when we think about translation and applicability in a clinic, for example?
So we really would like to study intact proteins and intact protein complexes and their interactions. The more we can look at the big picture, the more physiologically relevant our understanding is. And doing this is incredibly difficult. We can only do it, without exception, if we have purified a single protein complex. We don't have technology that can look at a whole human cell or a piece of human tissue and be able to do this analysis in the full complexity. We just cannot do that. So the methods that are much higher throughput that can analyze the very complex makeup of a single cell, that we can identify thousands of distinct proteins making up a single cell, making up a tissue, and so on. These methods look at smaller pieces of proteins. And there is a trade-off between being able to see the big picture, but having the limitation in throughput and having the limitation of working with isolated small piece of the system, to having methods that sacrifice some of the big picture, but they're much more powerful and scalable. And to some extent, technologies are aiming to bridge those two worlds so that we can, with the bottom-up methods that measure small pieces, we're trying to increase the size of those pieces. With the methods that can take that can take a picture of a complex. We're trying to measure larger complexes and maybe two complexes and so on. But they do remain isolated. It is the case that proteins are just incredibly dynamic, diverse complex, and we don't have yet the technology to be able to study the full complex proteome in vivo in a human tissue.
Do you think that if you were to cast yourself forward and say, well, what do we need to be able to do that? Is it the existing set of cameras, as you call them, that we have just need to get like better, higher throughput, kind of more specificity, sensitivity? Or do we also need other cameras? Like, are we going to be forward 5 years from now and there's going to be like six different ways to try to like kind of get a picture of what's going on at the proteomic level? Or is it going to be kind of the same three categories that you mentioned? They're just going to get better. And then they're going to be paired also with kind of more, call it like algorithmic or insight-based advances that help us to efficiently query the problem space.
Well, the easy part of the response is it's certainly both. The harder part is the relative contributions. It is undoubtedly the case that the existing methods are going to become better. Maybe some of those that are less powerful and less specific will become less used and they will see less investment, while other ones are going to get more investment and they have more of a room to improve. But I think methods, established methods such as mass spectrometry, will certainly continue to improve very substantially with us. This, of course, doesn't exclude that also in parallel, we develop other single molecule methods that are increasingly powerful and they're able to do certain things better, faster, cheaper than mass spectrometry, while they're not able, for example, to trace rates of protein synthesis and degradation at scale and protein modifications. So, and then, of course, it is difficult to know what nobody has yet invented. I'm certainly a strong believer in human ingenuity, and I think that there is a lot of space for brilliant young people coming up with ideas that nobody has conjured up yet, and that they're going to invent whole new technologies. I hope that happens. I don't yet know exactly what that's going to be. It's, again, easier to predict what existing technologies are going to scale. I guess what I'm going to finish by on this topic saying is that even without the huge enabling leaps of a completely different technology that I don't yet know of, within the existing technologies, within the realm of mass spectrometry, I can easily foresee orders of magnitude gains with ideas and concepts that we've developed. And in fact, recently, Schmidt Futures, the philanthropy foundation of Eric Schmidt, gave a substantial amount of funding and support to start a nonprofit research organization, Parallel Squared Technology Institute here in Boston, to advance proteomic technologies and increase throughput by orders of magnitude by parallelizing the analysis based on technologies that we originally developed and demonstrated in my academic lab here at Northeastern University. And those technologies were noticed by Convergent Research, Adam Marblestone, and Schmidt Futures. And together, they actually approached us with the interest of advancing those technologies at a faster scale by doing it as part of a nonprofit research organization, having more resources than what is typically available in an academic lab, and especially in the context of the dearth of funding for nonprofit research from NIH. And this opportunity created by Schmidt Futures by Ken Griffin was very welcomed on my side, and also some senior students from my group at the time, including Harrison Specht, Alex Petelski, and they joined me in co-founding Parallel Square Technology Institute, where we are working on some of those approaches that at this point we can project, we can foresee that we can increase the throughput of analyzing single-cell proteomes by orders of magnitude, while at the same time increasing the depth of coverage, the number of proteins we can quantify, and increasing the quantitative accuracy, preserving the specificity. And that, of course, is going to be a welcomed improvement. And that, of course, will not be the end of everything that we need to do. Again, we need to think about protein interactions. We need to think about modifications, glycosylation of proteins. Proteins get covered by sugars. And this is really, really important for their functions. It's actually what determines blood and group types. Whether we can transfuse blood between different patients depends on sugars covering proteins. We want to be able to analyze those too. We want to be able to analyze protein turnover. We want to be able to analyze dynamics of proteins, signaling, changes in conformations, and so on. But I digress here a little bit in this direction just to make the point. And that even without the unforeseen breakthroughs, which likely will happen, I hope will happen, but even without those, at the moment, there are very clear paths that we see to very dramatically, very substantially increase the throughput, the depth, the capability of protein analysis. And this, of course, is going to have major implications both for understanding biology at a fundamental level, understanding this wondrous, miraculous world of fast-moving protein molecules that make us alive, and also importantly is going to have major implications for clinical discovery, making drugs that are far, far more likely to succeed phase two, phase three trials, and reduce the attrition in the pipeline, which has been such a big problem in the pharmaceutical industry.
And maybe the kind of, well, it's not really a follow-up, it's more a segue question, but, you know, recently, right, there was so much buzz about foundational models and then using that AlphaFold and other ones, kind of predicting the structure from the sequence. And obviously, you know, it's a big win to a certain degree to some, you know, how it was done before. But when we think kind of on a big picture, how helpful and important is actually this?
I think that AlphaFold is a genuine triumph that is built upon decades of research. And it's a very, very special case that many experts, including me, have acknowledged how special it is. On one side, we had a tremendous amount of highly accurate, highly precise, very well annotated data collected by crystallographers over decades with billions of public dollars invested in creating that database with a lot of clever ideas of various algorithm developers accumulated, such as evolutionary covariation, conservation of amino acids, that really informed the development of what they think is indeed a very powerful, very helpful technology for predicting static protein structures. And the most obvious next step in that direction that may entities, many academic groups, and DeepMind and others are moving towards is predicting static structures of larger proteins, maybe two proteins bound together, protein complexes, and that remains a frontier much more challenging. None of that touches anything about protein dynamics. And the big problem with protein dynamics is that we don't even have the data. So the AlphaFold triumph of predicting static protein structure depended entirely on having the high-quality data set. And when it comes to many of the frontiers of the proteome, we don't have not large data sets. We don't have small data sets. We cannot begin to train any kind of large models that can make meaningful predictions. And I think while the case of AlphaFold, I think, is a great triumph that is helpful, there are many other cases around that that to me appear more hype than substantive. Many of the models that are called foundational are called foundational because that term doesn't have a very clear definition. And if we push for that definition, then we find that Newton's laws are actually more foundational than any of what's called foundational. And there are all sorts of examples of models advertised as foundational that perform miserably on benchmarks where simpler models perform way better. And of course, every time when there is an exciting development, there is substantive progress and there is a lot of hype and hoopla that is not so good. But I think that continuing the development of based on transformer type models, deep learning models, is very much dependent also on generating the right kinds of data to be able to train these models. And it's also highly dependent on human intelligence. There is a tremendous amount of human intelligence that went in constructing AlphaFold, including outside of DeepMind. DeepMind, of course, is a brilliant team of people who deserve a lot of credit for developing AlphaFold. And they were also very honorable in giving plenty of credit to the academic community that for decades before they ever started working on protein structure, developed ideas that they learned from and ultimately incorporated into AlphaFold. So I think that there is prospect for developing more good technologies based on deep learning, and that's a very exciting prospect. But we shouldn't think of that as being a miracle. Now that we have transformer models, we can predict just about anything. No. We also need to have the data, we need to ask the right questions, we need to have the right teams that formulate questions that are well-framed, that are actually answerable, and that is much harder. In many ways, I think static protein structure was a very special problem that is hard to replicate with another one, and biology remains, relevant things in biology remain difficult to predict because we haven't even measured the individual composition of individual proteins in human cells, not to mention their interactions, not to mention their dynamics, turnover, and so on. So and that's an exciting frontier for research that I expect that we'll be making progress, and that progress will also be reflected in having more and better therapeutics, not overnight, not in a very short time frame, but more in a sustained long-term time frame.
Maybe just a follow-up question. So basically, if I'm understanding correctly, you know, because proteins are very dynamic, we need kind of molecular dynamics modeling. And that's much more informative for us if we are, for example, trying to make a drug versus if we just have a static representation, right? And so, you know, I have seen kind of some papers trying to kind of say, hey, we need to somehow bridge LLMs and those models with kind of, you know, physical, kind of electrochemical, kind of physical kind of properties so we could actually model that. Do you think something like that is possible, or the path will be more kind of trying to record molecular dynamics and then kind of use that as the input for the training?
I think it is feasible, but it's very difficult. So the models, when we simulate molecular dynamics over any long time scale, are approximations. And therefore, any molecular dynamics that we simulate on a longer time scale may not be entirely correct to a degree that it's difficult to precisely know. There is exciting progress made by the group of D. Shaws by building special purpose hardware that is able to substantially accelerate this very, very difficult computational problem. Simulating proteins, especially large proteins over long time scales, is incredibly, incredibly computationally demanding. And that can be made more tractable by special purpose hardware, but even in those cases, the results remain approximation, and the results are usually over limited time scale, limited number of proteins, limited sizes of proteins. So there are a lot of difficult problems to be resolved to advance our ability to do the dynamic simulations, to generate accurate data at scale, to then train deep learning models. And I think that is an important avenue that is fruitful to go. And its complementary avenue that can be very helpful is also advanced experimental methods that can provide constraints and can give us a baseline check. How well are we doing with these simulations? Can we experimentally provide some constraints and confirmations that what we are simulating, which inevitably is going to involve some approximations, is actually giving us the right results.
Maybe kind of to segue a little more on the stuff, on some of the research that you have been doing. You know, recently you have published a paper trying to do the single cell proteomics. Obviously, when we think about genomics, the single cell has been all the rage in recent years, and it definitely made a lot of impact. And, you know, how we see this is, you know, cell is the fundamental unit of life and everything happens at the level of the cell. So we need to be at that resolution. So can you just talk a little bit about, you know, what you have done and then how that can be that impactful, you know, in the clinic? Is it that for diagnostics or for the kind of developing new drugs?
That's a wonderful question. And thank you for that. It's something that obviously is very dear to my heart. I'm a very big believer in the need to measure proteins in single cells. And that's why we spend so much effort on that front. Perhaps one of the simplest ways of explaining why that's important is that many proteins are regulated primarily by degradation. And these are not bystander unimportant proteins. These are proteins like P53, the guardian of the genome, the most frequently mutated protein in cancer that is so important for metastasis and lots of other functions related to cancer. This protein is synthesized more or less constitutively at a constant rate, more or less. So we constantly make it. And how much of it we have really depends on how it was modified and whether it was degraded or not. So if we measure P53 template messenger RNA, this tells us relatively little about the protein abundance that performs the functions related to metastasis and cell division. And P53 is not such an exception. There are all sorts of molecules in our bodies that are made to be immediately degraded. For example, HIF-1 alpha. It's a protein that throughout our lives, since we are born until we die, will always be made. And as soon as it's made, it gets oxidized and gets degraded. So if you measure hypoxia-inducible factor in my body now, you're going to measure virtually nothing. My body is making it. It's immediately degraded. If the oxygen level in the room starts decreasing, then the protein is not oxidized. It's building up. None of that's detected at the level of the messenger RNA for hypoxia-inducible factor. So all of these proteins that have important pivotal functions are much more informative if measured as proteins, but it goes beyond that. There are many signals in the body that interestingly are transmitted by proteolytically cleaving a protein, breaking it in part, and then one part moves to the nucleus, the other stays in the cytoplasm. An example of that is NF-kappa-B that regulates inflammation. And single-cell proteomics methods that we developed, they're able to measure those proteolytic cleavages and tell us in single cell which cell was activated, how the protein was cleaved, which caspase, which enzymes were active. And this is much more mechanistic information that gets to the heart of how cells are functioning. Single cell RNA sequencing has been tremendously helpful to be able to cluster cells and be able to say we have n number of clusters and these are their states. But being able to identify what makes those cells different and how they function together is built upon assumptions upon assumptions upon assumptions of messenger RNAs producing certain proteins. And building inferences upon assumptions is precarious. It's useful, but if we can reduce those assumptions by directly measuring the proteins, that gives us a higher confidence inferences. And one aspect of single-cell proteomics that I'm particularly excited about is the possibility of measuring not only protein abundances, but being able to measure more about protein functions, protein conformations in single cells, because they can directly tell us whether a kinase is active or not in that single cell. And that, again, goes to molecular mechanisms, not just to descriptive data sets that tells us this, we have n number of clusters, but tells us something about the information transduction inside of individual cells, tells us about protein interactions that make those cells different. And these measurements, the more functional measurements, remain more challenging. There are fewer examples of those being done as compared to just measuring protein abundances. But nonetheless, there are also these examples, as technologies mature and become more powerful, these examples are becoming more numerous, and these analysis is becoming more feasible. One type of analysis that I'm very excited at the moment, done by a colleague in my lab, Andrew LeDuc, for example, is being able to trace protein synthesis and degradation in wise-behaving mice in single cells. We can feed the mice with amino acids labeled to its stable isotopes and then watch how they get incorporated into the proteome so that each cell records its own travelogue of what proteins it's synthesizing, what proteins it's degrading. And then when we sacrifice the mouse and sample the tissue at the end of the day, we can tell for each cell what it was doing, what the proteins were doing when the mouse was still alive, which I think is opening a whole set of experimental questions and that we can address that we couldn't do before. And in that way, I think single-cell proteomics is adding important dimensions and capabilities on top of what we can do with single-cell RNA sequencing. Single-cell RNA sequencing is very useful. It remains a method that we use in many cases, but it has its limitations that are increasingly acknowledged by the community, both the strengths and the limitations. And they think, if I'm to summarize all of this discussion into one sentence, that will be single-cell proteomics has the capacity to give us much more functional readouts of single cells, moving us much closer to molecular mechanisms.
But you do think that, you know, the single cell is the resolution where we want to be and stay in biology?
It's a very useful resolution. In some cases, the resolution is single organelles. For example, Recently, another colleague, Jason Durds, in my lab, a postdoctoral fellow at the time, studied protein transport from the cytoplasm to the nucleus. And to be able to characterize that, we needed to isolate and quantify proteins in nuclei. We want to isolate and quantify proteins in different organelles, sometimes mitochondria, would be membranes. So in some cases, we want to have higher resolution, and this is achievable. It becomes clearly increasingly harder. But the single-cell resolution is clearly a good resolution that is appropriate for many experiments that we can learn a lot from. And in some cases, we want to increase that resolution.
Yeah, the way I think about it, or as a layperson, is, cancer is a very good example for why single-cell works, because it's such a heterogeneous disease. Like, if you take a cancer sample and you blend it up as a smoothie, and then you, like, say what's going on here, you're potentially missing the subpopulation of cells that is causing the real harm. Like, you can't actually see what's going on in the cells that matter, and so then you can't design a treatment that would treat that subpopulation, or it's hard to know what treatment is the right treatment for that subpopulation. And it sounds like, as you're describing, if you're just measuring the transcriptome, just measuring kind of like the thing that's taking the DNA and turning it into proteins, you're actually missing the fact that the thing that could be going wrong is actually the proteins that exist are being degraded at different rates. And so you could have a subpopulation of cells where the problem is kind of like a specific protein is in higher abundance that is actually the thing that's causing the cells to grow uncontrollably and be the driver of the cancer.
And then if we measure proteins and their modifications, in addition to the constituent elements, the modifications of proteins oftentimes carry information and signals. So we can also get closer at the individual cellular level of being able to listen to the talk, to the conversation between cells. And that is very important. That is very important.
And maybe the last kind of question, in next 5 years, what do you see as the three biggest kind of frontiers in science in studying the proteins?
I think one is democratizing and increasing access to powerful methods. At the moment, the cutting edge methods that we have access to that can enable so much research already, even without further development, are not widely accessible to many colleagues. And a big part of that is information. It's really intellectual limitation, not just financial. Financial and resource, that is limitation, but a big part of the limitation is conveying the possibilities, educating people about what's possible and how to make good use of it. That in some ways might seem boring perhaps to some, I think it's incredibly important to be inclusive and to bring everyone along. And as we are developing cutting edge powerful methods, to also think how can we broadly share this with as many people as possible. And accessibility also means reducing cost, which is coupled to increasing throughput, increasing power. For example, with mass spectrometry, the really expensive part is the instrument time in the machine. If we can generate data at a thousandfold higher rate, then the cost per single cell is a thousandfold lower. That's an attractive thing to do. And that can further increase adoption and make it more powerful. My second wish for a great potential, great breakthrough that can happen is that I would like to be able to measure, analyze, and understand, interpret at much more scalable level protein interactions. This is something that has been appreciated as an important frontier for a long time, certainly by a sizable group of thinkers and intellectuals in this area. But our ability to do these measurements has been so limited that de facto what has been happening is that the progress has been very slow, at least very slow relative to my wishes and my expectations. And I'm very excited about possibilities of technologies that we have, mass spectrometry and others, to very substantially accelerate progress in that direction. And I think this will have lots of practical applications in developing better therapeutics. The third one, I would say, is dynamics and time. Time and dynamics is an inherent aspect of life, and it's one of the most neglected dimensions across all omics, because it is hard. With omics, we tend to take snapshots. And snapshots are useful, and sometimes we try to infer time, we call it pseudo-time. Pseudo is not, it's important. We shouldn't forget it's pseudo. We should think of technologies that allow us to get to time and dynamics, because life is a dynamic process. And there are many aspects of life that we cannot understand from snapshots.
Makes sense. We need to go from Polaroid cameras to video cameras. That's like,
And that helps tremendously with inference, for example. If you have a sequence of events, the temporal order is one of the really reliable factors that in generally we have to infer causality. Without that, we are left with associations that are difficult to interpret causally.
Well, Nikolai, it's really been fascinating to dive into the world of proteins with you. Really appreciate you taking the time. And I hope to see that, you know, thousandfold improvement in mass spectrometry and everything you're working on come to fruition.
Sounds great. Me too. And thank you so much for this conversation. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Cheers.
Thank you.
What a fascinating conversation with Professor Slavov. Nemo, what surprised you most from that conversation, or what was the thing that you picked out of that where you were like, hey, I didn't actually appreciate that?
Well, I think just a kind of really confirmation how complex is the proteome, and then not only the proteome, but that proteins itself are extremely highly dynamical structures, and that actually we are so far actually to deal with that problem, which then is so important for the applications such as the drug discovery, for example. And so I think that's something that's kind of really stuck in my mind, given all the AlphaFold and those development, which I still think that they are very seminal, but it's just the tip of the iceberg where we need to be.
Yes, it very much seems like tip of the iceberg. In some ways, it's a little bit hopeless, as in we're never going to understand all of this complexity, but it's hopeful in that it means there are so many directions to move to increase our understanding, which ultimately will yield, you know, better treatments, better return on R&D for companies using that data correctly, you know, great business prospects for companies that are able to develop the tools that then can yield that insight and kind of build our understanding of the world better. So yeah. That has been, all right, last point, jump in.
Yeah, maybe, I mean, just like something that goes with this, I actually was not really aware how underfunded is the kind of proteomic research. And I think, you know, kind of highlighting that, I think, is very crucial, because it's, you know, as we kind of repeat again, proteins are the doers in the cell. And so we want to know what they're doing to be able to manipulate them for the in diseases and in other instances. And so just understanding how little funding is going there, it's something that, you know, we should kind of discuss more, because really we need much more funding and people power here to deal with this kind of complex issue.
100%. And thank you so much for joining FYI, the For Your Innovation podcast. Nemo, thanks for joining. Please like, subscribe, and tell your friends about the podcast. That's how we get such great listeners. And we will see you next week.
ARC believes that the information presented is accurate and was obtained from sources that ARC believes to be reliable. However, ARC does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information, and such information may be subject to change without notice from ARC. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in this podcast may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARC's current views and assumptions, and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements.